Access number 10657 relay team.
Major Lewis, relay team. I was asking you about rotation, and you were saying that it was a week in the line, and then you'd be a week out in reserve.
I think that was about it, yes. Anyway, in late September, the Greeks took over from the Royal West Kents, who were on the right of the 8th Battalion. They dominated no man's land to a greater extent than we did, in that what they did was to send out fighting patrols all the time. They weren't bothered about the reconnaissance. Their idea was to get at the Italians just as quickly as they could. They had a very unpleasant habit, as proof that they'd actually found some Germans or Italians, they would bring their ears back. And their Italians, the Italians really were their hated enemies. The Greeks really didn't make any distinction between friend and foe. They didn't have any of our ears, admittedly. The brigadier said, look, no more patrols near the Greek patrol areas for the time being, and we left them severely alone. Because although we'd got the six Durhams on our left, we got the Greeks on our right. But apart from the fact that they used to go out on these very aggressive patrols and show their absolute hatred of the Italians, on another occasion we were invited to dinner by the Greek company commander, and three or four of us went over, and this was a fantastic spread. They'd had the whole lot sent up from Alexandria, a five-course meal, sitting in the desert, chatting and laughing and what have you, and having a drink and everything, and yet the following day they became completely animal again, almost. But there we were. We had this very pleasant evening with them.
Could they speak English?
Yes, because they were, most of them were Alexandria. They lived in Alexandria, and I think they spoke French and a little English as well. You know, we got on very well with them because they were quite different people when they were having a meal to what they were like once they got out in the Depression. I mean, we considered what we did was of more value than what they did, because they got casualties, obviously, doing it. And they didn't really tell us anything we didn't know, whereas at least we were macking the minefields.
How did they actually get to the Italians? Did they actually go out to the Italians?
Oh, they must have. They obviously must have gone right through. And as I said, they wouldn't have done that without getting casualties, and it wasn't really necessary for all that, you know. They certainly didn't surprise anybody in no man's land. They went right up to the German and Italian lines.
So they were raiding rather than
absolutely
patrolling.
Absolutely.
Did they wear British uniform?
Oh yes, yes. Oh, yes, they had the British khaki on. No, they were remarkable people. I mean, there was another occasion when the reserve attack company was doing a night attack formation, which actually moved forward through the Greek gun lines, so that was some little way back from the front. And the Greek sentry had been warned, but he saw these figures approaching him in the moonlight, thought it was a Germans or Italians who'd broken through or something like that, and immediately opened fire, cut a groove in the steel helmet of the company second in command. So the company went to ground. By this time the rest of the Greeks had been roused, and all hell was let loose. They were shooting left, right and centre. And the colonel was with this party doing this particular exercise, together with the intelligence officer, Dennis Neal. So he said to Dennis Neal, he said, do something about it, Dennis. He said, can't you speak Greek? So Dennis said, well, I only know one word. So Jake said, what's that? Dennis said, audaxi, A-U-D-A-X-I. Dennis says, it means friend. So Jake says, right, he said, get on your feet, he said, and walk towards them, shouting the word audaxi. So poor old Dennis Neal had to get up with bullets flying all over the place. and walked towards the Greeks. Jake admittedly got up with him and shouting out Daxi, and finally they stopped firing because they thought it was absolutely hilarious, thought it was the funniest thing they'd seen for years, until Jake, who was a very fiery character and couldn't speak any Greek at all, let him really have it. He went for them. He swore he never used the same word twice in one sentence. And we didn't exactly part good friends. So that was really the episode with the Greeks coming into the Alamein line. By early October, the British offensive had been planned almost to the last detail. For October the 23rd, this was the target date. The main attack was going to be in the north by full moon. Gun, tank and air support on a vast scale, for the 8th Army anyway, on a four-division front, supported by 900 field guns, over 1,000 anti-tank guns, 1,100 tanks, 500 fighters, 200 bombers. A weight of offensive that we had never experienced before. A massive weight of artillery, not big compared to later in the war, but a very big for that particular time in the Western Desert. And so far as we were concerned, during the month of October, prior to the big attack on the 23rd, the situation didn't change very much. The daily artillery duels continued, with the Gucci firing at us and our gunners firing at them. And then we had this tragic situation when a party of Cheshires were filling sandbags. They ignored a warning from some of our chaps nearby, and the sniping gun ranged on them. A shell landed beside a slit trench where two men were sitting, talking to each other. One was a Cheshire, one a Greenhard. They were brothers. They'd met for the first time since leaving the UK. One of them was killed, and the other one was evacuated straight away, more or less gone off his head, and there were no other casualties. But it simply proved that you couldn't, unless you had to be out in the open, you were taking unnecessary risk if you did. And they were sitting on the edge of the slit trench. Another example of the I think this was a German gun, actually. They'd really got us pretty well taped, because battalion headquarters and headquarter company once or twice got the odd shell, and the officer's mess very nearly got a direct hit. That's the battalion officer's mess. This was because Colonel Jackson banged his head on the roof on several occasions, got very annoyed about this, and he said to Corporal Cutty, the mess corporal, "Get hold of the sappers and tell them to raise this ruddy roof several feet above ground level." Cutty said, "Well, do you think that's a good idea, sir? Because, you know, we're going to get fired at." "Do as I say," said Jake. And, of course, as soon as they got the roof up 2 feet, the gun opened fire. Two mere near misses. They almost got a direct hit. And, of course, the roof was ripped down immediately. And in fact set a foot lower, but they got it down so that Jackson had got to go another foot or whatever it was down to avoid bumping his head. But they were pretty good.
What was the roof made of?
The roof was made of tarpaulin, I think, and possibly you might have had the odd bit of this corrugated iron stuff stuck in, maybe at both ends or something like that. And that was... that was quite a... Mind you, we didn't see all this happening. We could see it. We knew something was going on because there were some shells plopping over at battalion headquarters. But as I've said before, nobody really took very much notice of what went on if it wasn't actually happening to us. A new A company arrived early in October. When the battalion left Amarea in August for the landing ground area, Major Chambers had stayed behind to train the 100 reinforcements that had been sent through to Amarea, Amarea, that's right. Now, they lived with the Greenhards at Mariopolis, actually. They were trained by Major Chambers. They were very well looked after by the Green Howards. And although the troops were very well trained to UK standards, they knew nothing whatsoever about desert conditions. But they all adapted extremely well and adjusted very quickly, so much so that when they did come up to the forward area, they were almost ready to be put into one of the forward positions. They were extremely good. I know you're going to ask me where they came from, and I can't recollect that. They weren't Durham's, that I do know. But they were reinforcements, and rather different to what happened in Normandy, when they had a reinforcement of Welsh regiment once, when they did have a lot of trouble with them, because they didn't want to come to the Durham's. These chaps who came out to to Mariupolis were very good indeed.
Did they remain all together as a single company?
As a single company, yes. And they were commanded by Chris Beattie, and they went into supercharge as a company. I suppose that would have been their first action. I mean, that was quite a thing to go into as a first action, Operation Supercharge. But that would have been it, I think. Yes, A Company stayed, and then they eventually joined B and C that had been down in the Alamein line. During this part of October, patrolling continued, probing the approaches to the Anger Depression, plotting the minefields, and by now Dennis Neal had a most detailed map. A great deal of the credit must go to a man named Hurst, H-U-R-S-T. He was an ex-guardsman who had only joined the battalion in the Alamein line. He went out almost every other night. This brings me to the point I was making, that good people were given more than they should have been given because they were good at what they were doing. And, of course, he was killed eventually. So that meant that he was only in the battalion from the beginning of October until the 13th. He went out with a sapper corporal and a sergeant from C Company soon after stand down, which is after we stand down at night. Went into the Anger Depression, a bright moonlight night as usual. Hurst, a veteran of the Anger Depression, if you like, warned the others about tripwires, turned round, his own body threw a shadow on a tripwire, foot broke the wire, the antipersonal mine went off and practically severed the lower part of his body. Martin ran over to him and Hurst said, "Don't worry about me, get back into the line." The enemy defensive fire came down straight away. Always they would set their defensive fire off, same way that we did if anything untoward happened. Hurst was in great pain, couldn't be moved, although Martin tried to drag him out away, and he died shortly afterwards. Several attempts made by our stretcher bearers to get him out, but each time they got beaten back by the enemy defensive fire, who in all fairness didn't know that's what we were trying to do. But he was a very gallant officer, and it was a great loss to the battalion. And there was an ex-guardsman whom I imagine had been commissioned in the field. Never had he volunteer for anything, you know, always. So that was an unhappy situation. And then I think we come to the on October the 19th and 20th, Montgomery addressed all the officers down to Lieutenant Colonel in 30 Corps, 13 Corps and 10 Corps. And our CO passed on the gist of this to the 8 DLI officers, and everything that Monty had said to the senior officers was passed on by us to our officers and NCOs and men, because it was good stuff. Monty visualised a dogfight or a killing match, perhaps for as long as 10 days. He stressed the importance that we must never lose the initiative, and everyone must be imbued with a burning desire to kill Germans, even the Padres, he said, one per weekday and two on Sundays. He then explained how the battle would be fought and finished by saying, "entirely and utterly confident of the result." Well, you can imagine that when the men of the Desert Army were let into the secret, they were told on the 22nd and 22nd of October, when leave was cancelled, and they were given the wording of what the army commander had said. There was a tremendous state of enthusiasm in the 8th Army, and morale had never been higher. And I think that the men of the 8th Army knew that with Montgomery leading them, they were going to win. They just got that feeling, and morale was absolutely terrific. And this was entirely because he'd passed it down to the brigadiers and colonels, they'd passed it down to company commanders. Everybody knew what the army commander planned and what he said we were going to do. And that was really something quite unusual and very different to the Gazala situation.
So you hadn't had that sort of information before?
We'd never had an army commander to start with who ever gave a message of that sort. But having given it, to have it passed down, a message that was absolutely full of, you know, plenty of punch and let's get at them and all that sort of thing, was terrific. It was not the sort of thing, I think, that the generals of yesteryear would have done. I can't ever hear Auchinleck talking like that, or Alexander. I can only ever hear Montgomery talking like it, because that's what he was like.
But it is really a return to the early tradition, isn't it, of haranguing the troops before
I suppose
battle.
So. Yes, and I think you're right. You've got to do this, really. You know, you've got to do it. I mean, our chaps are pretty good. They'll do what they're told, and they'll do what they're told even if they don't know why the hell they're supposed to be doing it. But if they are told why they're supposed to be doing it, they're even better.
I'd like to ask you a few things about this period. Now, you passed over the fact rather rapidly you were promoted company commander.
Yes.
So you couldn't remember exactly when that had happened?
Well, it happened after I'd come back from the Middle East Training Centre. It wouldn't have happened until after that. And so it happened when we were in the southern sector of the Alamein line, but not when I first arrived back there, because initially I was in C Company, because looking through C Company commander's notes, he made a reference to the fact that when I was second in command, I took several patrols out into the Anger Depression. Therefore, I was 2IC to E and English of C Company when I came back from the Middle East Training Centre, and I was then promoted company commander before we left the southern sector and moved up to the north.
Presumably then you were a captain?
Captain, yes.
When did you get promoted to captain from lieutenant?
Oh, that would have been at that time.
At the same time?
Yes, once you became a company commander, you were more or less automatically promoted. There weren't any lieutenants as company commanders, they were all captains.
What was your role as second in command of C Company?
Well, from what I mean, I don't remember all this well, but from what Ian English was saying in his written notes, quite a lot of it was patrolling into the Anger Depression. But, you know, a second in command is really the role of a second in command in a situation like that. He really doesn't have very much to do, particularly with a man like Ian English, who's a first-rate soldier and a marvellous company commander. He didn't leave his second in commands much to do. So I didn't have a great deal, which probably accounts for why I was going into the depression several times. I mean, you've got to take your turn. You've got to go around the company positions at night with the platoon commanders and see that everything's all right. You've got to probably look after the admin side, the second in command of the company, make sure that everybody's fit and well, all that sort of thing. There's quite a lot of admin jobs fall your way, I think. And then in an action, of course, you're supposed to be able to take over from the company commander when necessary.
So you're really acting as his deputy?
That's right, yes, that's really what it comes to. But he's got a sergeant major as well, and a company quartermaster sergeant. And if they're both good at their job, it's mainly an overseer's job, a company second in command, under those particular conditions.
Now, when you became company commander, what additional duties did you have then?
Oh, well, when I became company commander, that would have been of B Company, then the first thing you've got to do is to get to know your platoon. You meet platoon commanders, your platoon sergeant, your sergeant major, your company quartermaster sergeant. You've got to get to know as many of the men as you've got time to get to know. You've got to make sure that your lists are up to date of who are in the various sections, that you know the exact location of everybody, where the Brens are sighted. Make sure that they're being cleaned properly every day, because they used to have a lot of stoppages on Brens if they weren't, particularly with the sand. Make sure that the section positions were satisfactory and didn't need any more work done on them. In other words, the first thing to do is to check up that the bloke who was company commander before you has done all the things that ought to have been done. Go over and have a chat with the Cheshires, because they were on the right of the right-hand forward company, and that sort of thing.
Were you actually in control of the Cheshires? Because they were scattered around in little detachments, weren't they?
Well, no, there was only two Cheshire machine guns, one or two Vickers guns, in other words, on each flank. We weren't in... I think they didn't operate under the control of an infantry company. They were there to support the infantry company, actually, in their own way, because they could do a better job themselves than us attempting to tell them what to do, because they were probably in a better position to see what needed doing than we were.
Did you handle their admin?
No, that was nothing to... Well, you could have a situation where if the quartermaster of the Cheshires back at right back at B Echelon might have said, well, look, can it be arranged that when you take the forward company's rations round, would you take our chaps round as well? That could well have been an arrangement between quartermasters, and would certainly have been the logical thing to do, because there would only be the one truck going round there at night with the company quartermaster on it, and they wouldn't want any more than one if they could help it.
Did you have a full complement of platoon commanders?
No, not at that time. Very low. I didn't get I was short of two platoon commanders right up to the afternoon of supercharge. So I just had one platoon commander at that particular time, and a sergeant major, and not much else. And I was made up to strength with officers just before supercharge in the afternoon, and they were both killed that night. Didn't even last 12 hours. So we certainly didn't. When we moved up into the north, up to the north, we got our company made up to strength up there.
So did you then have... there were only two officers in your company then?
That's
you
about it.
And a
yes.
platoon commander.
That's about it.
And then two platoons commanded
by sergeants.
Right. And then the company sergeant major as a general.
That's it.
Factotum.
Yeah, he was a very valuable bloke. I mean, you'd got to get on well with your company sergeant major. And I don't know any CSMs in the Durhams that weren't easy to get on, but they were all. Most of them were regular soldiers. They knew their job and they were worth their weight in gold. You could get a lot of help from a sergeant major if you cooperated with him, you know. And he would keep a lot of difficulties away from you too. And in action, they were terrific always. Now, a good CSM, a good company quartermaster sergeant, is almost more important than three good platoon commanders, because you've always got your sergeants, platoon sergeants, who can take over.
Now, you mentioned going back to battalion headquarters.
And yeah.
I think you said that you went back every day.
Oh, not every day. No. it might be necessary to go back if Jake wanted to brief anybody on something. He might have particularly... Well, you had to go back there, actually, to be briefed on a patrol by Dennis Neal, who would show you the very latest situation on what was in the Anger Depression and what he particularly wanted to know about. You had to go back to battalion headquarters or via battalion headquarters if you've got weekend leave. You had to go back if you wanted to see the MO for anything. Anything at all, really. So you could be, maybe every other day, I suppose, you made the trip up the wire and down the other side to battalion headquarters.
What sort of distance was it?
1,000 yards, I suppose, something like that. Quite a long way. I would have thought that. Yes. Actually, I would have thought that it's... You see, the two minefields, the outer circle and the inner circle, at their widest part, are about 2,000 to 3,000 yards apart. And battalion headquarters is about another 1,500 yards on that. So you've got 4,500 yards to go. About 3 miles. Quite a lot, actually. More than I'd realised. So they were well and truly out of the way there, you know.
What did your company headquarters consist of?
Dugout. Small dugout. Below ground level. With just a... just a... a sort of... You could cut something to sit on out of the side, almost, you know, like a... You could cut shelves out of the side, you know, to stick books and things in. But really, it was just a dugout about... Not as big as... I suppose about 6 foot by...
About 6 foot by 6 foot.
Yes, below ground level. And there was just room for me to sort of sit inside and, you know, do a little bit if I had any letters to write or any reports to write or anything. Very, very small indeed. Covered over with a bit of corrugated and a bit of Hessian on top. And that was about it.
What about the personnel at company headquarters? Who did that consist
signaller.
Of?
A signaller would have been... He wouldn't necessarily have been in there. I'm thinking now about really the hole that I occupied in the ground that was my home, as it were. Signaller could have operated from there as well, but it's more likely that he'd have his own little hole about 3 or 4 feet away with all his equipment and wireless set and everything. Then I had a company runner, of course, who could be sent out to the platoons if necessary with messages. And the platoons had company runners too. Sergeant Major was nearby. Company Quartermaster Sergeant wasn't. He'd be back in the with the battalion quartermaster.
So it's a headquarters essentially of four people.
Yes,
four or five people.
Yes, that's about it. You'd have a if had it been up to strength, there would have been a company commander, company second in command, company sergeant major, platoon runners. And the signaller.
What means of signalling did you have?
Well, this was just the wireless, the 18 set, which was just it was landline signalling. Back to, we had a line running out to the there'd be a line running from the gunner OP back to battalion headquarters. We'd probably have a line if the gunner OP was in our area. We'd probably have a line from company headquarters to him. And a line from company headquarters back to battalion.
This is telephone line?
Yep, telephone line.
Not radio?
No. No, not that I can remember. Not like the tanks. They had these RTs, didn't they? No, ours was the old gripe, you know, wind the thing round and speak.
Did you get regular visits from the battalion commander?
No, they didn't come down our way very much because there wasn't a great deal of sense in the CO getting written off, so there was no sense in him coming down just to have a look round. He did come down occasionally, and we didn't discourage that, but we did discourage brass hats. And there was one marvellous occasion when we had a visit from some real brass hats. And Philip Hampson, who was the mortar officer, was back at battalion headquarters at the time. And they were speaking to him and talking to him about the mortars and that. And Philip says, well, I don't... he said, you have to be fairly careful. He said, the counter-battery mortar fire, sir, is very heavy in this area. we didn't see any more of them. They disappeared. But generally, Jake used to... He would come round maybe about once every 4 days. I mean, he wasn't afraid to come or anything like that, but it didn't make any sense for him to risk his life unnecessarily, because he had got a battalion to command when he knew very well that everything down there was pretty well okay.
How was the platoon? How were the platoons laid out, Randy? Were you sort of in the middle with two platoons in front of you and one behind you, or were you?
No, we would have probably had two platoons forward,
yes,
and one back, and company headquarters next to it.
So you were next to the reserve
platoon
location.
That'd be about it. That'd be about it. Yes.
Now, we mentioned rotating the company back into reserve and then forward. Did the platoons rotate round from one position to another?
No.
So, in other words, if you were reserve platoon,
and you were in for that particular time, you stayed reserve platoon, unless, of course, they had any casualties, then they might have done. It might have been necessary to do it then. I mean, there were casualties while we were in that position from this damn sniping gun, and if a section lost a couple of men, for instance, they would probably swing them back into reserve and put one of the other sections forward, or I would, or whatever, you know.
So could you then swap sections around amongst the platoons?
You could if you wanted to. You could if you were. Not amongst the platoons, no. Only amongst its own platoon. I mean, you've got three sections to a platoon. I wouldn't have put a section from such and such a platoon somewhere else. But we might have, if we'd had any casualties, we might have sent yes, you're right. We could have sent a section back and replaced it with a section from the other platoon.